Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. I'm very, very deeply grateful to be here tonight. I'm also very nervous, so just sit back and relax because you're going to be here for quite a while. I'm going to take my coat off, and that means I'm going to stay for a while. Because I need the freedom that I get from having that off. Now, I want to begin my remarks this evening by bringing to all of you assembled here and all the good members of AA throughout the land of Texas, the greetings from the Canadian people of AA, whom many of you know and have asked me about over these last couple of days. It's also my privilege and my pleasure to bring you greetings from the General Service Board of Alcoholics Anonymous and to say on behalf of my colleagues the best wishes and greetings on this year 17th annual conference. I want to thank Blanche and Charles for extending to me an invitation and the hospitality that has been shown to me since my arrival by Stu and Helen yesterday and by Larry and so many people today has been absolutely overwhelming. And I'm deeply, deeply grateful. When I arrived yesterday afternoon, I was invited to go water skiing by the speaker from last night. And I had known Lynn for some time, and I declined, and then the invitation was again extended today. And I thought perhaps I should take it up. He said that he and David were going water skiing, and I said, fine, I'll go along with you. And when I got down to the lake, I discovered that I couldn't do it by canoe. And I decided that wasn't a very safe way, so I didn't go. I think that Lynn may have been trying to get rid of me. I'm not sure. However, I want to tell you that when the chairman said that I was nervous, that's very true. I do this kind of thing very frequently, and no matter where I go or how often it occurs, I still have that terrible nervousness, and I suppose that that's a very good thing. I suppose that if I ever lose that, I would be in danger of becoming totally ineffective in my remarks, and I hope that I never really do, because I'm very sure that it's the higher power's way of telling me of the responsibility that I have. Tonight is no different. I am nervous. I began to get nervous this afternoon, and as I walked around and talked to so many and enjoyed the conference, and particularly the speakers, Lynn's message, and the beautiful messages we heard today, I grew more nervous, and I reached the podium here tonight, and just before I came up, I went over to Dick, and I said, would you say a prayer for me? And I didn't know that he was going to do it in front of all of you, but I thank you very much, Dick. However, my nervousness can best be explained in a little incident that I want to share with you to illustrate how nervous I am and still feel that way tonight. Some many years ago, after I'd come to Alcoholics Anonymous, I had been invited to speak at one of our major institutions, major penal institutions in Canada, namely the Kingston Penitentiary. Now, I had never been in Kingston Penitentiary. I should have been, but I hadn't made it. But in any event, I accepted the invitation to attend there on the occasion of one of their annual anniversaries. As a matter of fact, the warden extended an invitation to me to go down and join him for lunch. And I went down to the penitentiary, and I had prepared myself very well what I wanted to say to these people, because I knew that they were incarcerated and that I would have to be most careful not to make them uncomfortable, and certainly because we were there by privilege and not by right. And I had prepared myself very well. So anyway, I arrived at the warden's office, and he took me into the staff dining room along with some of the other members of the staff. And we had a very nice lunch, and following lunch, we proceeded to go over to the assembly hall of the institution. And as we proceeded through the various corridors, and they kept locking doors behind me, I got more nervous and more nervous. We finally arrived in the assembly hall. It was a hall that would be something similar to this, and a large number of people were present, and of course, they were all prisoners. And if I thought I was nervous before, now, mother of God, was I ever nervous, you know. And there I was, and I couldn't get out of there at that point. They'd locked all the doors. And I was terribly nervous, and they finally got up on the platform, and they went through a lot of fol-de-rol to finally got around to introducing me as the speaker. And I stepped to the front of the platform, and I had a terrible experience. I had one of those awful, awful experiences a speaker hopes he shall never have in his entire lifetime, because as I stepped to the front of the platform, my mind went blank, and I couldn't think of a single thing to say. And after what seemed like an eternity, and which was only a matter of a few seconds, I'm sure, I'm saying to myself, I've got to get this thing underway. And I hope I'll never forget my opening remark to them was that I was glad to see so many of them there, you see. Don't do that in the penitentiary, I want you to know. I'm very glad to see so many of you here tonight. I'm deeply grateful. Now, I want to start my remarks this evening by saying to you that I'm a recovered alcoholic, and my name is Peter Waters, and I'm a member of the Oakville group of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, some of you will undoubtedly say, well, perhaps the Texas heat has got to him. Did we hear him correctly? And I want to tell you that your ears are not deceiving you. You did hear me correctly when I said I was a recovered alcoholic. And I take as my authority for that statement a quotation from the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, this is the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, my friends. And I have discovered recently that if you want to hide something from somebody in AA, you put it in the big book. They don't read it as much as they should, you know. And when Bill Wilson was through writing this book in 1939, he took the liberty that is that of an author, and he wrote a foreword to the first edition. And I want to quote to you from that foreword, and I quote, "We of Alcoholics Anonymous are more than 100 men and women who have recovered, who have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body to show other alcoholics precisely how we have recovered is the main purpose of this book." End of quote. Now, when you use language as direct and as positive as those statements are, my friends, it doesn't leave too much room for friggin' around. And that's what I want to talk about tonight. Not friggin' around. I'm not going to do any talk about that talk. A lot of people can tell you about friggin' around. I'm not here to do that. I want to talk about programs of Alcoholics Anonymous. Not as anyone who has any insights more than anyone else, not as anyone who has been given any knowledge more than anyone else, but as one who, by the grace of God, and the example that I found in this fellowship and the prayers of a loving mother, I've not had to take a drink for nearly 17 years. And to me, that has to be a miracle. It has to be a miracle for one who could never live a day without it. And so I want to talk about the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I go to a lot of meetings, as I'm sure many of you do, and I cringe sometimes when I go to a meeting and I hear a statement like this, and this is no reflection on an individual, and somebody will say, "And we'll now have the 12 suggested steps." And I think, Mother of God, where did they find that? In my book, it says, "Here are the steps we took. Here are the steps we took." And if Wilson had wanted to take the literary liberties that were at his disposal, do you know what he might have gone on to say? He might have gone on to say something like this, "And if you want to stay sober, you better took them too." I don't know how else they're going to work, eh? So I want to talk about the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I go around to meetings and I hear things like people would say, "Oh, you practice the program your way and I'll practice it my way. And if I do that, I'll be drunk tomorrow." You know, I have to practice it the way it's written. And they had some earthly idea that there was going to be a kook like me coming down the pike or several. And they said, "Let's put numbers on it. He'll screw it up." You know, they call it the 12 steps. And that's what I want to talk about tonight. But in order that you will know that I didn't just come in out of the heat for something to do, I'll qualify fairly briefly by saying that I drank too much, too often, in the wrong place, at the wrong time. And if you're an alcoholic, that's exactly what you did. I am not interested in the quantity or the quality. It's what the stuff does to you, eh? And people come running to me, I'm sure you've had this experience, and they come to you and they say, "So-and-so's an alcoholic and he's drinking." And I don't find anything unusual about that at all, you know. Alcoholics have been drinking since they crushed grapes. And they'll be drinking for a long time to come. It's when they quit drinking that I find that very exciting. And that's what I want to talk about. But to qualify, I've said that I drank too much for a long time. Alcohol made me hurt those I didn't want to hurt, took me to places I didn't want to be taken to, and robbed me of things I didn't want to be robbed of. I was indeed a fortunate person to have been born into a good Christian family. My parents worked very hard to provide me with all the advantages of life. And yet, as I look back over my own life and observe the still practicing alcoholic today, isn't it so true that we find that he or she goes out of their way to hurt those they love the most. I don't know about you, but it was certainly true in my case. I can remember myself at the local watering hole. The hail fellow well met the last of the big-time spenders and hangle it right into the last dog was hung. And then you'd stagger home and you'd slam the door and kick the dog and break the dishes and raise hell. If dinner wasn't ready, you'd raise hell. If it was ready, you wouldn't eat it anyway. And who had to take the brunt of this each and every time that this occurred? A very beautiful, gracious lady, my mother, who did nothing to deserve that sort of thing. I don't know too much about Brownwood, Texas, but I do know a lot about a place called Oakville, Ontario, and that's where I was raised. And I know that, you know, I would get all dolled up on a Saturday night and I'd go out in the town, and I would always end up in jail. Always end up in jail. Now, I never met a social drinker in jail. Never once. And I don't know about Brownwood, but in Oakville there, along about 8 o'clock on a Sunday morning, I'd be in jail, and the police would come by, and they'd say, Peter, do you want to call, make a telephone call? Of course I wanted to make a phone call. I wanted to call my mother. I wanted to have her come over and bail me out. But you see, my mother, as I told you, she was gracious and beautiful. But there was another thing you should know about my mother. As gracious and as beautiful as she was Irish, you know. And she had the temperament of the Irish, and that's a little fiery, you know. And so I'd be allowed to make a phone call, and I'd call my mother. And the phone call was very brief and one-sided. It would go something like this. Mother, I'm in a little bit of trouble being caught tomorrow. We'll go to 10, bring some money, and hang up real fast. You know, don't let her get at you. Dear God, she'd tear you apart, you know. The next morning, my mother would arrive at the local court, you know, and Oakville's a small community, as I'm sure Brownwood is. And I'd come to know over the years that in small communities, people don't read the local paper to find out who's in trouble. They go to court to find out who's in trouble, eh? And my mother would arrive at the local court to 10, And there'd be a couple of old ladies in the back of the hall. One leaned over to the other and said, that Waters boy's in trouble again this morning. There's his mother. Now, in our court, I don't know about Texas, but in our court, they always kept the front row seats vacant. Now, they were for the special guest, you know. And they brought up the special guest from downstairs at 5 to 10. And at 10 o'clock, the old man would come in. That's the judge. Now, if any of you have ever been in a court of law, and I'm quite sure some of you have, that you know that when the judge comes in, my God, are you ever polite? And you do what you're told. And you're hoping now that the clerk will make a mistake with your name, and he'll mumble it, and people won't know who you are, and you won't be embarrassed, eh? But there's no such luck. He says, Waters! You can hear him for 4 blocks. Everybody in town knew I was in court. My mother's sitting out there, don't forget, eh? And now you're standing in front of the judge, and you're hoping that you can really lay a trip on the old man, and you can impress him and let him know that all those things they've been saying about you are not true, that you've just been having a bit of bad luck, okay? And you're standing there, and you're really going to impress him. And then you suddenly realize that you've got a tie on and no shirt, you know. And he looks at you and he says, I've seen you before. He'd seen me so often he thought we were going steady there for a while. And my mother was in court, eh? Then alcohol took me to places I didn't want to be taken to. I didn't stand on the city hall steps in downtown Oakville and declare to the world that I would be on Skid Row by the time I was 30, but that's exactly where I was, my friends. Oh, yes, it's not hard to get onto Skid Row. Some of you know that. You can walk on, fall on, roll on, tumble on, anything you like on. But, oh, my goodness, it's hard to get off of Skid Row. But if I had to go to Skid Row, I'm deeply grateful I went to the one that I did and not the one that I've come to see so often in my sober days. When I've been privileged to do a bit of 12-step work, in a very affluent part of our world. And I'm privileged to go and call on some of these boys who have created their own Skid Row behind the beautiful bronze drapes of the Broadloom floors of the Lakeshore Boulevard. And they're making love to the toilet bowl and they don't know what's the matter with them. And they're in and out of every brook in the country. Dear God, we don't know how lucky we are that we're here. And then alcohol robbed me of things I didn't want it to rob me of. It robbed me of, this is a very expensive organization to get into, you know. Oh, my goodness, it's very expensive. It cost me $40,000 to get into Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm going to stay around till I get my money back. And at the rate it's coming in, it'll be a long time, I want you to know. No, you see, it robbed me of the respect of my family. It robbed me of the respect of my fellow man who had placed their confidence in me to the extent of allowing me to sit as their council member. It robbed me of my business. But you see, I'm totally convinced the practicing alcoholic develops what they call a seared conscience. I suppose Reverend Dick would probably be able to describe it much better than I could, but the best description of a seared conscience I've ever been able to find for myself is that if you took a piece of round steak and you threw it in the frying pan and you cooked it for about 7 days, it would become like a piece of shoe leather. Your teeth couldn't possibly penetrate it, and that's the way that my conscience had developed. I didn't give a damn. I didn't care who I hurt. And I went on my way, and I ended up in our largest city in Canada, in Toronto, on Skid Row. And it was in that condition, my friends, nearly 17 years ago, that I was privileged, by the prayers of a loving mother, and the grace of God working through the beautiful people of Alcoholics Anonymous, to be brought through the doors of AA. So is it any wonder that tonight I want to speak, I want to share with you for a little while about the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. But in order that we may understand one another in this sharing tonight, I would like to set my remarks within the context of three terms of reference. The first term of reference that I would ask you to consider is to keep an open mind. That's very, very important. And it's going to be very important to you tonight before I'm finished, because I'm going to say some very disturbing things. And I hope that I do. Because I've come to learn in my time in this program that the things that have been said at meetings such as this that have stirred me to think have been the most worthwhile things I have acquired. I sincerely believe that when we come to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and we get rid of the booze, we end up with a thinking problem, not a drinking problem. And if in my efforts here tonight I can stir someone to think, then any efforts I've made in getting here will have been very worthwhile. So I exhort you to keep an open mind. I've learned over the years that there's a great deal of difference between an open mind and a vacant mind, and so please keep an open mind. The second term of reference is that I must buy this. This is a package deal. I have to buy it lock, stock, and barrel. If I go around deluding myself that I can get sober on a cafeteria-style basis, I'm just putting off the inevitable day that I'm going to get drunk. I'm just putting off the inevitable day that I'm going to get drunk. I have to buy it lock, stock, and barrel. When they talk about reservations in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, my friends, they are not talking about whether you're going to have one drink or not. If I could have one drink, you could have one drink, none of us would be here tonight. We'd be out having it. It's a warm night. No, they're talking about whether this thing will work or not. And I have to buy it lock, stock, and barrel. And the third term of reference I would ask you to consider is that I must be willing to pay the price. And I'm not talking about the price it cost you and I to come through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. Indeed, I'm not. I know that there are many of you in this room here tonight, and some of you I know personally, who paid an enormous price. The price of your family, the lives of your families and your loved ones, your businesses, in many other ways. No, I'm not talking about the price it cost you and I to come through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm going to ask you to consider the price it cost you and I to stay in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And so with those terms of reference clearly laid before you, I would ask you to consider for the next short while that what we are about to do is to take a journey through the steps. Now the reason I would ask you to consider and conjure in your mind the idea of a journey is because any journey, no matter what its duration or its destination may be, of necessity, begins with the first step. And that's exactly where we'll begin our journey tonight. Oh, you've heard them, and I have heard them, the profound ones, who would tell you that the first step is the most important step of the program. Now, I have no earthly idea whether the first step is the most important step of the program or not, and I'm not going to argue about it, but there's one thing I'm absolutely certain of about the first step. I'm absolutely positive of about the first step. It's in the right place. And they didn't put it anywhere else, you see? And indeed, it took me a long time to discover that that's exactly where it was and where it should be. And I look at the first step and says, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol and our lives have become unmanageable. And I look at that step and I say to myself, what inspired Bill to commit to paper the first step of our program? And I know while there may have been many things that inspired Bill, I had the privilege of knowing Bill Wilson and then talking to him on many occasions. And one of the occasions I talked to him, Bill had been inspired by a number of things. And one of those beautiful things that had inspired him was a painting. A painting that we're all familiar with. A painting that would adorn the walls of the buildings in which we're gathered here in this beautiful complex. And we've all seen that painting, and it's the painting of the master standing at the cottage door, rapping at the cottage door, seeking admission. I would ask all of you to take a very close look at that painting the next time you see it. Examine it rather carefully, and you'll discover that there's a very unusual thing about the painting. And the unusual thing about the painting, my friends, is that there is no handle on the outside of the door. Obviously, we have an announcement.
Excuse me, there's an emergency call for Alicia Hawkins. If you see me, I have the number, please. Is she here?
Alicia Hawkins. There she is. If you examine that painting very closely, my friends, we'll discover that there's no handle on the outside of the door. The handle is on the inside. And if you want this miracle to take place in your life, that has taken place in the lives of very nearly a million people in the world tonight, then you have to open the door. You see, it's like you having a headache and me taking the aspirins. It won't do your headache any good at all, eh? You have to reach deep down within yourself and find the handle and open the door. And my book tells me that if I open the door ever so little, that that's all that's necessary to allow the grace of God into my life, and that this I can begin this way of life. And so I look at the first step, and it says, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol and that our lives had become unmanageable. I had no difficulty with the first half of that first step, my friends, none whatsoever. You see, I had a sponsor, I look at it and it says, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol and that our lives had become unmanageable. Well, you wouldn't have to really get past grade 2 to come to the conclusion that there was something wrong, because every time there was trouble, there was booze, and every time there was booze, there was trouble, and which came first, the chicken or the egg? You could debate that one for a long time. But I had a sponsor in those days that if he wasn't, he should have been a sergeant major in the First World War. He would say to me, Waters, do you accept the fact that your life is unmanageable, drunk or sober? I say, hold it. And for 45 minutes, I'd tell him all the wondrous deeds I had accomplished, how I'd been chairman of this, president of that, and owned something else, and something else, and something else. And when I'd get all unwound, he'd say to me, and do you accept the fact that your life is unmanageable, drunk or sober? He was in a terrible rut. He couldn't get out of that rut at all, eh? My friends, I submit to you that I have to accept the fact that my life is unmanageable, drunk or sober. I further submit to you that anyone who's been sober for 3 months, 3 years, or 33 years, who reaches out and takes a drink, knowing full well where that would take you, would you call that an act of manageability? I would have to call it a complete and total act of unmanageability. And for heaven's sakes, don't come at me with the famous statement that I hear from time to time, oh, but I'm an alcoholic. You'd think it was a license to commit murder, you know. Has nothing to do with it. Stone cold sober, I reached out and took a drink, knowing full well where that would take me. I have to accept the fact, my friend, that unless I apply the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous to my life, that my life is unmanageable, drunk or sober. And now we'll go to the second step, and you're probably saying, thank God, we thought he was going to stay in the first one all night. Take a look at the second step, and it says, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. And I say, now where did Bill get the inspiration for that? And I don't have to look very far. Let's look at the words. We came. We came to Alcoholics Anonymous. We presented the body warm. In some cases, it wasn't too hot, but we got here anyway. And then we came to. Do you remember coming to? I remember coming to. In some places, I just as soon forget I was ever in the first place, you know. The bottom end of our city jail was one of my favorite coming to places. That's where the Venetian blinds run this way all the time, you know. And then we came to believe. And this is the part of my talk that I always enjoy the most whenever I'm speaking on the steps. Because, you see, I have a very distinct advantage over everyone in this room. I have the distinct advantage of standing in front of this audience and seeing all the beautiful faces, the warm, receptive faces that I know are in front of me. The beautiful people that I always find at every AA gathering, and this gathering is no different. But you see, there's a very unusual thing happening in this audience at this very moment. Most of you don't know me, had never seen me before, and as I got up to begin my talk, probably there was a mental process went on, and it went something like this. Why, that fellow looked like a minister when he came through the door. I bet you he's going to talk about God. Well, you want to believe I'm going to talk about God. There is no shortcut to that, my friends. I'm not going to do that to embarrass anyone, to create any controversy, or to drive anybody away. No. I'm all too well aware of the fact that we may have some people with us tonight who are having difficulty finding God. And I'm going to be so bold as to suggest to you that if you're having difficulty finding God, you can share mine until you find your own. I first suggest to you, if you have one, hang on to him, because you're going to need him before I'm through with you tonight. Eh? Because it says we came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. It didn't say he would. And there's a great deal of difference between whether he could and whether he would, and I suggest we should look at that very closely. Now, we've come to the end of the second step, and I submit to you, really, what have we done? And I don't think we've done very much, my friends. I think I further submit to you that you can sit in that chair that I just vacated right there, and you can take the first two steps of this program without flexing a muscle. They're completely and totally contemplative in nature. They require no outward manifestation whatsoever. But if you're still on this journey that we embarked upon, then we are about to embark upon the most exciting part of the journey, because it's going to involve a thing called action. Action is the magic word. When I came to this program, my sponsor, every second word he said was action. And I used to get so mad at him, I said, if you say that word once more, I'm going to kill you. But I've come to learn that there's a great deal of difference between activity and action. I meet people, as you have, I'm sure, and they run up to you and they say, I went to 47 meetings last week and I still got drunk. Don't know where they found time to get drunk, but they got drunk anyway. Why'd they get drunk? Because there was an awful lot of activity and no action. Now, I have told a story many, many times, and This is not a suggestive story, but it's a story that I heard over a family radio station as I was traveling one day, and I'm going to take the risk of telling this story because it kind of typifies the kind of action I'm talking about. A story about the farmer. He was a rather prosperous farmer, dairy farmer, doing rather well. One day it occurred to him that if he raised his own cattle, he could be much more prosperous. And that would entail purchasing a thing called bull. So he had looked over his resources, and he had enough money to buy a bull that could raise his own cattle, and he went shopping for a bull, and he found exactly the animal he wanted. It had everything that a bull is supposed to have. They wanted an awful price for this animal. They wanted $20,000. Now, that's an awful lot of bulls. But anyway, mortgaged everything he had and bought the animal and brought it home, put it in the pasture with cows, and there was no action at all. And he thought to himself, he said, I'm ruined. All my money sunk into that stupid animal and nothing happening. Heard about a veterinarian who had a preparation, would help to get the bull active. Took the bull down to the vet. The vet discussed it with the vet. The vet gave the bull a shot, brought the bull back to the pasture, put it in the pasture with the cows, and my God, there was all sorts of action, and this problem was solved. And there was an old neighbor farmer down the road watching this performance. He went over to the farmer, and he said, whatever did you give the bull? He said, to make it act like that. The farmer says, I don't know what it is, but it tastes like peppermint. Action is the magic word. And the first of the action steps begins in step three, where it says we made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. I never cease to be amazed, my friends, at the tremendous insight that Bill Wilson and his gang had when they put this thing together. You see, because I just look at step three at every time, and I'm just absolutely astounded at the tremendous insight, because it says we made a decision. And the weeping and wailing I did on this step was unreal. I said to my sponsor, I said, look what you've done to me. You brought me to this wonderful outfit, and now you want me to do the impossible. You want me to make a decision. Did you ever meet an alcoholic who was foreign to making decisions? I made so many decisions, I put myself out of business 3 times before I got here. Okay. I'm sure you would identify with me, maybe not you in Texas, but any Canadians would certainly identify with me with the tremendous world-shattering decisions we have to make in Canada on a very cold Monday morning when it's 32 below zero, and you have to decide whether you're going to be at the liquor store at 5 to 10 or 5 after, you know. Well, you're going to buy one bottle or two, and you come here and say, I can't make any decisions. I've been making them all my life. But I never cease to be amazed at the tremendous insight that Bill had when he put this thing together. It says we made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understand it. And I just didn't stop and say, we turn our will. Here, God, here's my will. I just gave my will to God. Did you see it? Of course you didn't. I don't know what it is myself. I don't know if it's bigger than a breadbasket, tall, fat, thin, short, black, blue, or white. But it doesn't stop there. It says we turn our will and our lives over to the care of God. Now, my most prized possession today is my life. I like me. As a matter of fact, I think I'm a nice fella. And now, that opinion may not be shared by too many, but nonetheless, I think I'm all right. I've learned that in Alcoholics Anonymous. I've learned in AA that if you don't have any self-worth, if you don't think too much of yourself, that you've still got a problem. And I think I'm all right. I have some dignity and some self-worth and some self-esteem about myself today, and I've learned that through my recovery. But did you see it? Of course you didn't. I don't know what it is myself. I don't know if it's bigger than a breadbasket, tall, fat, thin, short, black, blue, or white. But it doesn't stop there. It says we turn our will and our lives over to the care of God. Now, my most prized possession today is my life. I like me. As a matter of fact, I think I'm a nice fella. And now, that opinion may not be shared by too many, but nonetheless, I think I'm all right. I've learned that in Alcoholics Anonymous. I've learned in AA that if you don't have any self-worth, if you don't think too much of yourself, that you've still got a problem. And I think I'm all right. I have some dignity and some self-worth and some self-esteem about myself today, and I've learned that through my recovery. And so I'm my most prized possession today is me. Now, you let me use an analogy, if I might, along the way. We all are acquainted with a chap somewhere along the way who drank himself right to the bottom, came into AA, and did very well, and began to do things right, and began to rebuild his life. And when he gets a few pays under his belt and things begin to go in the right direction, what's the first thing that he does? You know, and I know, that the very first thing that he does, he goes over to the finance company and from there over to the used car dealer, and he buys the largest automobile he can buy. And that becomes a prized possession. And there's nothing the matter with that, my friend. And if you don't believe that that's true, I wish you'd follow me around the country sometime when I'm invited to speak in many boondock places that you never know where to get to or how to get to, and I have no earthly idea where the church is in the meeting, and I never have any difficulty finding it. I just keep driving around the community till I find the church with all the big cars outside, and then I know I've arrived, eh? Look at the parking lot out here tonight. It's loaded with them, eh? Now, that becomes a prized possession, that first automobile, and there isn't, you're going to go to meetings, do 12-step work, go to conferences, take the family out, and so on. And there isn't a single one of you in this audience here tonight who would take the keys to your automobile and go over to the Four Corners in Brownwood and hand them to a total stranger and say, here, take this for 2 weeks and bring it back to me when you're through with it. And if you would, there's more wrong with you than alcohol, I'll tell you that. How much more is your life a prized possession? And here you're asked to turn it over to God. What kind of a God is he? I had a lot of things to learn in this step. I had to learn that this is the same God that we deal with in every step of the program. We don't have a different God for different steps. And this was the same God. And I had some questions about this God. What kind of a God was he? What was his track record? And would he look after me? And I guess the most important question I had to ask God was, will he give me back me? Because I didn't want to end up like the hole in the donut. And I never have any trouble answering that question, my friends, because I live alone in my home in Oakville, and I get up in the morning at 7 o'clock, I shave, shower, and shampoo, I have a bite of breakfast, and I take my book and I go into the den, the little den that I have at home, and I have a period of reflection. Now, there's a very good reason for my doing that, and the reason I do that is because that's what it tells me to do in the book. It says, upon arising, these are the things you do. That's when you get up in the morning, you do these things, you see. And so I go in there, and I read for a few minutes, and when about 10 to 8 comes, I put the book away, and I have a period of reflection, and I reflect upon the opportunities of the day. I reflect upon the people that I will be associated with, and I prepare myself and condition myself to go out and meet the world. And at 8 o'clock, I'm in love with everybody. I just absolutely love the whole world. There isn't anybody I don't love. There isn't a resentment within 1,000 miles of me. I'm just madly in love with everybody. And at 8 o'clock, I leave the side door of my home. I get into my automobile, and I drive twice the length of this hall, and I come to a major intersection. And that son of a gun won't let me in that line of traffic out there, you know, when I get real mad. And the air becomes blue, and I hate everybody. Do I ever wonder whether God will keep me or not, you see? My biggest single problem every morning is to get out of my own way. That's my problem in the morning, is get out of my own way. And so I accept the fact that I have to turn my will and my life over to the care of God as I understand them. And then we go to step four. And four says we made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. And everybody gets uptight. Oh, my God, he's going to talk about his sex life. Doesn't say anything there at all about your sex life. Some cases would be rather interesting, I guess. Others would be very short. Doesn't say anything in there at all about it. It says we made a searching and fearless moral inventory, not an immoral inventory. We dug, we uncovered, we sought, we found, we weren't afraid of what we might find. And that's, you know, but the key word in step four had to be the word inventory. The inventory is a process that is used in the business world to take stock of the good and the bad so that you might arrive at a balance sheet in order to know what your profit and loss picture is. And in personal life, it's not any different. But there's a cardinal rule that must be followed when you're taking an inventory. And that rule, my friends, is today is the day we're going to take inventory. The pencils are sharpened, the paper's ready, and the staff's instructed. What's the first thing that you do? The very first thing that you do is you lock the door. If it's coming in and going out like there's no tomorrow, how do you ever arrive at a balance sheet? Eh? If I'm going to take an inventory of my life, I'm going to stop long enough and take an inventory of my life, and I'm going to take stock of what's in there today. Not what used to be in there, what's going to be in there, what might be in there. No, I take stock of what's there today. This is a now program. I take stock of my life today. That's what my book tells me. And then I take that and I go to step five. And I warn you, don't stand near the door on step five. You get trampled to death. They head for the hills. The mortality rate on step five is the highest it is on any step in the program. Why? Because it's the honesty step of the program. I always like to recall a little story about a French-Canadian boy. One night at a meeting in Toronto, he was talking, giving his first talk, and he was very, very nervous. And it was obvious from his remarks that he had a lot of difficulty getting his initial sobriety. He'd get drunk, get sober, get drunk, get sober. And one night he went to a meeting, and the speaker had spoken at considerable length about the fifth step, the tremendous catharsis they had experienced, the terrific relief that they had experienced. And he says to himself, he says, that's the thing I need. He says, I go out of that place, he says, and I find a priest, and I tell him everything. Everything, he says, I tell him. He says, that release was so great. He says, that release, he said, she was so terrific. He said, I went back the next week and told him the truth. Because it says we admitted to God, to ourselves, to another human, the exact nature of our wrong. See? For 3 solid years after I came to this program, I hit my head against a stone wall trying to make myself believe it didn't hurt. Trying to change the things I couldn't change. Refusing to accept me the way that God had made me. I didn't like me. I wanted to be different, and I didn't like me. And thank God for the old-timers. Thank God for the old-timers in this program who took me by that very collar and ran me up against the wall and said, Waters, get on with the job you're here to do. Change the things you can and accept the things you can't. And from the day I began to do that, my friends, the hostility and the fear and the resentment and the garbage went out of my life, and it's not had to return. And then we go from there to step 6. 6 and 7 should rarely be talked about apart, but I'm going to separate them tonight just for purposes of saying a few things on each one, because in step 6 it says we're entirely ready to have God remove all our defects, all these defects of character. I fell into 3 categories on step 6. The first one was, yes, God, I'm entirely ready to have you remove all these defects of character, except the one I do on Saturday night. I'd like to hang on to that one for a little while, right? And after a while, I became another person. For sake of a name, we'll call him Charlie. Charlie's one of these guys around the program's very quiet. Oh, my, my, he's so quiet, he'd drive you crazy. You wonder what he's up to. And you get sitting beside him one night and say, how are you doing, Charlie? Oh, I'm doing fine. How are things going, Charlie? Oh, I'm waiting for something to happen. You know what's going to happen, eh? Charlie's going to get drunk. Because anything that's going to happen has already happened. You're sober. Anything else that's going to happen, you are going to have to make it happen. Because I firmly believe, my friend, that God works through the natural to prove the supernatural. He works through you and you and you and you to prove to me that he's there. Right? You see, I was born into an Irish Catholic family, and the marvelous thing about being an Irish Catholic is you're never a drunk. You just got the failing. I had the failing for many years, you know. And I want to tell you that I would go down and see Father and take the pledge. I took so many pledges that Father ran out of them, you know. I don't know whether any of you are familiar with the pledge or not, but the pledge is an old Irish custom for those who had the failing, you know. And there's a little story that bears repeating about the pledge, about this poor little old Irish priest. He came from a very remote part of Ireland to Canada one time to visit some of his very affluent relatives. He got off the airplane at the international airport, and my goodness, there were cars and buses and planes and people all over the place. They'd never seen anything like that before. And they whisked him down to the Royal York Hotel, and he no sooner got his name on the register at the hotel, up to the 17th floor, and there's a little bellboy running around, dusting things off and turning things on. And when he was all through, he came over and he put his hand out, and the poor old priest looked completely bewildered and baffled by all this nonsense. And the young fellow, being a smart young whip, he said, Father, he said, it's obvious to me. He said, you're not accustomed to our ways of doing things in this country. He said, I'm a bellboy. And he said, we render these services to our patrons, and they usually recompense us with a little bit of money. And he said, that's the way I make my living. And with this, the poor old priest turned scarlet altogether. And he said, oh, dear God, son, he said, I don't have any money. He said, I belong to an order that has the vow of poverty. And he said, we don't have any money in our lives. He said, and he said, I haven't got a thing in the world I can give you. And then he said to him, son, do you drink? And the young fellow's face lit up like a light bulb. He said, yes, Father, I do. He thought, here comes the Irish whiskey. Yes, Father, I do. Well, he said, kneel down, and I'll give you the pledge. You know. That's just about what it was worth, I want you to know. Right? I remember one time my mother said to me, God rest her, she said, now, if you want to share this family and live in this home with us, she said, you're going to have to mend your ways. And I said to her, I'll go down and see Father. And I hope I'll never forget going down to see Father on that occasion, because about 2 months before that, we'd gotten a new pastor. He was much older than the previous one, and I rationalized he'd be much wiser in the ways of the world, and I'd go down and see him. I went down, and I sat in the study with him for 2 hours, and I discussed my problem. And my final remark to him, I said, Father, I don't think I'm an alcoholic. God, Pete, he said, I don't think you are either. He said, I tell you what we'll do. He said, we'll sit down, and we'll have a drink, and we'll talk about it, you know. My poor mother could never figure out why every time I went to the rectory, I came home loaded, you see. And she'd say to me, where have you been? I said, down to see Father. She said, you couldn't have been. Look at the shape you're in. I said, you should see him. You know? He didn't have to walk. I did, you know. Yeah. And it says, you know, and then I, after a while, I became the third person. And the third person, you know, before I go on to being the third person, I must tell you that, you know, during this time, I'm amazed in this in the last few years at how many people are looking for God. I'm absolutely amazed. You know, you go all over the place, and people are looking for God. It's worse than the Christmas rush, you know. I met a friend of mine the other day. He said he was going out to California to look for God. I said, you're wasting your time. God hasn't been in California for years, you know. Most God-forsaken place I was ever in my life was California, you know. And I went looking for God, and I knew there was a God. Of course I knew there was a God. I'd been raised in that environment. And I looked in the chapels and the missions and the cathedrals and many other places, and I couldn't find God. I couldn't find God. And before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I came to the conclusion that God was a good guy and I was a bad guy, and God didn't want anything to do with bad guys. And I came to AA that way. And I hope I'll never forget finding God in AA. I hope I shall never forget finding God. It was on a Saturday night, just like tonight. And I was sitting at the Port Credit Group in the second chair in the front row. And the speaker that night was one of those sainted, beautiful gentlemen that had been around our program for many years. Very eloquent gentleman. Tim Dwyer, God rest him. And he delivered one of the most eloquent, beautiful, spiritual messages you could ever hear. And he told me that night where I would find my God. He said, just reach out and touch the person next to you. He said, that's where God is. That's where God has always been. And that's where God will always be. He walks with you, and he talks with you, and he shops with you. He comes in different sizes and different colors, and he speaks different languages. And if you can't find God in your fellow man, you need more help than we have to offer. I pray that you can find him. And then I became that third guy, and we call him George. Now, George, one of these guys, bounced around the program all the time, you know, and one day you see him, he doesn't look very well, you say, what's the matter, George? I'm mad, he said. What are you mad at, George? I'm mad at God. What did God do to you? God didn't take away my defects of character. Well, obviously, George never read the big book, because it says in there that God is not likely to take away our defects of character. We'll have them till the day we die. We're not saints. We're not saints. It'll be a long time canonizing me even after I'm dead, you know. Yeah. We grow along spiritual lines. But thank God we no longer have to suffer from those terrible emotional jags where our kidneys were very closely connected to our eyeballs, you know. And you could cry because it was Tuesday or Wednesday or whatever you wished, eh? And after you get all through crying, I don't know about you people, I used to get a thing called telephonitis. My phone bill at the end of the month looked like the national debt. I was in public office at that time in our country, and I would call all the public figures across our country, and I would tell them how to run the country. And the last phone call I would make was to the Prime Minister, and I would tell him how to run the country. And quite frankly, I think he should have taken my advice. It's in an awful mess right now. And as I said, 6 and 7 should rarely be talked about apart. These are the two steps that get more discussion than any other steps in the program. I swear to heavens, there are some groups that run serials on them. You go there this week and they're having a very in-depth discussion about what's the difference between a defect of character and a shortcoming. And you go back 6 weeks later and they're still talking about the same thing. One of my friends told me the other day, he said, Waterson, he said, I got it all figured out. He said, a defect of character is when you look at a good-looking girl, and a shortcoming is when you catch her. No, every time I look at step 7, I'm reminded of the parables. Now, I don't want anybody to get worried. I won't go through all the parables tonight. I'll come back another time and do them. But I want to take some liberties with step 7, because in there, the word humbly is the derivative of the word humility. Humility in the dictionary is defined as self-knowledge based on truth. In other words, know thyself. Know thyself. And as I say, every time I look at that, I'm reminded of the parables. But I want to take one of the parables, and I'm going to take some liberties with it because I want to speak to you about it tonight. The parable of the talents. I'm always reminded of that when I look at step 7. Because the boss called these three fellows in one day, and he said to the first fellow, he said, here are 5 talents. You go do with them what you will. And the second guy got 7, and the third guy got 10. Let's have a look at these fellows, eh? The first fellow, he got 5 talents. What did he do with his talents? He went out into the field, and he dug a great big hole, and he buried them, and he covered them all over because he didn't want anybody to know that he had them, eh? He didn't want anybody to know that he had them. Does that kind of remind you of some people we see in Alcoholics Anonymous from time to time? Oh, dear God, don't tell anybody I belong to Alcoholics Anonymous. No, I don't want anybody to know that I go to Alcoholics Anonymous. I wouldn't want anybody to know that. I'll drive 48 miles down the street so that people won't know I go to Alcoholics Anonymous. Staggered all over the main street for 30 years. But don't tell anybody you're sober. How in the name of God you reconcile that, I'll never know. That has to be a form of our insanity. In Oakville, it's a city of 75,000 people. I'm about as anonymous as the post office. I got a letter the other day, marked Peter W., and they put it in my mailbox. Some people in Alcoholics Anonymous get so anonymous you can't find them. I got a Christmas card 2 years ago from John M. If he's here, I'd like to thank him. I don't know who he is. And dear God, they go right into the woodwork, you know. They disappear. That is not anonymity, my friends. We really mess that one up badly when we consider that that's anonymity. That's living with the fear that brought us here. And I pray God we can get rid of it. Yes. And the second guy, he got 7 talents. And the second night he had them, he went down to the hotel and he spent them all. And the third guy went out and he used his. And a while later, the boss called these 3 fellows in. He said to the first fellow, he said, I gave you 5 talents. What'd you do with them? Oh, he said, I've got them. And he ran out into the field and he dug them up. And he brought them in. And they were rusted, rotten, corroded, useless. They'd never been used. Never made a 12-step call. Never set up the chairs. Never poured the coffee. Never swept the floor. Never put his hand out for the new man or the new gal at the door. Probably never put anything in the plate either. We'll talk a little more about that one later on, I want you to know. My part of the country, they call that the Catholic part of the meeting. He said to the second fellow, he said, I gave you 7 talents, what'd you do with yours? Oh, he said, the second night I had him, he said, I was down at the local hotel and I bought the boys around. A reminder of the kind of guy you've been watching for a long time. You bring him to a real crackerjack of a meeting. When the meeting's over, you go over to him and you say, how did you like that? He said, I'm not an alcoholic. I was just having a bad time. Doesn't die. No. They smell that way. They go on for years. They destroy everything that's decent and human long before they ever take their last breath. And he said to the third fellow, he said, I give you 10 talents. What did you do with yours? He said, Master, I went out and I used them, and here are 20. Here are 20. He doubled them. My friends, that's what this whole thing is all about. And if you haven't got that message, then go back to square one and find it. Because that's what's in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. We don't hide in Alcoholics Anonymous. This is not a hiding place. I cannot stand people who hide in Alcoholics Anonymous. I refer to them as AA hermits. We don't come here to hide. We come here to find out what our talents are, be they ever so little as they were in my case. And we get out into God's sunlight, and we become better fathers, mothers, sons, daughters, citizens, employees, or whatever the case may be. And then we go from there to step 8, and it says, in step 8, we made a list of all persons we'd harmed, became willing to make amends to them all. And if ever I'm going to develop a resentment, it's going to be on step 8. I live in a very affluent part of Canada. Many, many discussion groups around the area where I live. And on a meeting night, I'll go to a particular one that I can think of that comes to my mind. And along the wall, there'll be about 4 or 5 guys that are going to take part in the discussion tonight. And they've been around since the year 1, and they're suffering a little from the material benefits of the program. They've forgotten a little bit, eh? And they've got, 75-cent cigars, diamond sixpins, $350 suits, driving Cadillac. Nothing the matter with any one of those things if you know how to use them. But they're sitting back, and tonight we're going to have a discussion on making amends. Step 8, eh? We're going to have a discussion of making amends. And I hear comments like this, and one guy will say, oh, I'm making amends. I bought the groceries last week. That is not an amend. That is an obligation. And the fellow sitting next to him, oh, I'm making amends. I bought the kid's shoes. You're supposed to buy the kid's shoes. Dill has told us what an amend is in his writings. He said an amend is to repair the damage. Not to buy the kid's shoes or the groceries. When you fellas signed that piece of paper in the minister's office after it was all over out front that said you take him for better, for worse, for richer, for poorer, in sickness and in health, and the death do you part, that's a very binding legal document. They call it a marriage license. And it cost some of you a lot of money to get out of it. Bill has told us in his writings what an amend is. An amend is to repair the damage. How do we repair the damage? Well, it says, we made a list of all persons we had harmed, became willing to make amends to them all. And then I come on with the famous statement, oh, but I didn't hurt anybody but myself. Lord, if the ladies would leave the room, I'll tell you what I think of that one. Eh? Didn't hurt anybody but myself. I staggered, spit, cursed, swore, fell four blocks along the main street of Oakville, night after night after night, and those are the same four blocks my mother had to walk every night, every day to do her shopping. And I didn't hurt anybody. You say, well, fine, your mother and father are dead, and the guy you owe money to, you don't know where he is. What can you do? Well, let me be so bold as to make a few suggestions to you how you make amends. You join Alcoholics Anonymous, and that's an amend to yourself. And after you're around for a while, you join a group. And come wakes, weddings, funerals, high water, whatever it is, if it's an 8:30 meeting, be there at 8:30. Don't get there at 29 minutes after 8. Get there in time to set up the hall and have the handout for the new man or the new gal, and don't leave before the seventh tradition. And if you do that real well, there'll be a couple of old bandits in the back of the hall keeping an eye on you, and after a few months or so, they'll send you down to intergroup. And you'll hear the message down there, you'll see, hear phones ringing, you see people active and so on, and you'll come back and tell your group about it, and the same two old bandits like Joe and Charlie will be sitting around, they'll say, one will message the other and say, let's hang on to them, we got a live one. Because 6 months later, they're going to make you GSR. And some people think that's a streetcar conductor or something. A GSR is a general service representative, the most important position that anyone can fill in the structure of Alcoholics Anonymous. And the privilege may be yours, it was mine, to go on and become active in AA as a delegate to the General Service Conference in 67 and 68. And in 1974, to have the privilege of being elected to the General Service Board. And again last year as an AAWS director. And you say, well, that's fine for a guy like you, Waters. You're extroverted. You like to do those kind of things. I'm very retiring. What's left for me to do? I have an excellent suggestion for the retiring. They call it money. Oh, you see, you don't talk about money in Alcoholics Anonymous. You're darn right you talk about money in Alcoholics Anonymous. Do you think that that book got printed in 9 languages and distributed in 92 countries for nothing? Do you think that the literature that you see on your literature rack rained out of heaven one day when nobody was looking into your group? Some of you had the same privilege as I had in 1965 when we stood some 20,000 strong in the city of Toronto in Maple Leaf Gardens in front of Bill Wilson, and we said to the world, I am responsible. When anyone anywhere reaches out for help, I want the hand of AA always to be there, and for that I am responsible. Would you not agree with me that the man or the gal in Belgium, Holland, France, Germany, Italy, or wherever it may be tonight has as much right to this program as you and I have? And if you believe that pledge of responsibility as firmly as I believe it, then you'll have a silent collection at your next group meeting. I gave this talk one time to a very large audience. There were 2,000 people in the audience. There were four ministers, and they all come up and asked me to join their church right away. Then we go to step 9. It says, may direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. I just have two very brief comments to make on step 9. I am saddened and grieved on many occasions as I travel throughout this land and throughout my own country when I find members of Alcoholics Anonymous who have been with us for many years and enjoying all the fruits of sobriety who would have the nerve to stand in front of other members of Alcoholics Anonymous and make derogatory and defamatory remarks about the most beautiful and wonderful fellowship in the world, about Al-Anon. It would be better if their tongues were cut out. I have heard Bill Wilson tell us from the General Service platform that there would be no Alcoholics Anonymous in the world today if it were not for the first two ladies, Lois Wilson and Ann Smith, the wife of Bill and Dr. Bob, who poured the coffee and put up with the drunks. I pray to God every day that it be his wish that Al-Anon will be allowed to walk side by side with the Great Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous as long as God wishes. And then I hear people who come to me and they say, don't talk to him and don't talk to her. They're not alcoholics. They don't know anything about us. Well, don't stop at my doorstep. Go on back and tell Father Ed Dowling, tell Sam Shoemaker, tell Harry Thibault, Sister Ignatia, tell Dr. Jack Norris that they don't know anything about alcoholics or alcoholism. They saved us from our own damnation, those beautiful non-alcoholic people. My friends, we sit in the comfortable pew. We don't have the only answer. But let us be grateful for the one that we've got. When the Lord looked down upon the face of this earth in 1935 and saw the suffering, he didn't go to the high and mighty, the learned, the rich, or the powerful. He went to the lowly drunk. And he placed into your hands and into mine one of the most awesome and beautiful gifts that he has ever given to man. He placed into your hands the ability to be able to carry new life to a man or a woman who is still suffering. A few short blocks from this, maybe a few short miles from this hall tonight, There sits behind those drawn drapes in a darkened room a man or a woman with a football in their stomach, and they don't know about us. Are we going to keep the doors open? Are we going to take our responsibilities seriously enough that we shall have the doors open as they were for you and I? Are we going to be sure of that by taking our responsibilities seriously? I know you will, and I pray that you will, and that you will encourage others to do the same. 10, continue to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. This reminds me of my entry into Alcoholics Anonymous. I came through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, assisted by two people, one on each arm. I had air-conditioned trousers on that night, front and back. I had mountain-climbing shoes. Those are the kind no heels on. You're always walking uphill, you know. I had a big sweatshirt on with a big M in the front. Don't know what it meant, but I had it on anyway. They brought me right up to the front row. Wouldn't you know it, eh? Wouldn't you know it? The second meeting I went to, my mother rustled up a clean pair of pants. The third meeting I went to, she got me a clean shirt. Fourth meeting I went to, there was an old guy who'd been around since the year one, knew I was having a tough time, came over and slipped me a few dollars. The next meeting I went back to, he said, how are you doing? I said, I'm not an alcoholic, I was just having a bad time. I had a clean shirt and $2. I went out and got drunk. The two worst enemies of the recovered alcoholic is good health and prosperity. You have to be very careful how you use those things, my friend. There isn't any one of you in this room here tonight that when you go to bed tonight, you would take a bag of garbage to bed with you. No, I don't think there's anyone in this room who'd do that. And yet that's exactly what we do when we don't promptly admit it. I'm shocked when some people tell me that they think promptly is anything from 22 minutes to 22 years. I have to get rid of the garbage today and fail as miserably as I do. I have to do it for a very selfish reason. It's conducive to good health and good sleeping. I submit that you try it. And then we come to step 11, and it says, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. Some of you get a little uptight when I come to step 11 and start talking about prayer. You say, my God, it's been going on for hours, and he gets on that, he'll be here all night. Well, I'm not going to keep you a lot longer. It's a warm night, you've been very patient, but I never make any amends or any apologies for keeping an audience long. No. Last time I was drinking, I spent more time than this guy trying to convince the fellow next to me to buy the next round. And as I recall it, I lost. No, I'm not going to spend a lot more time, but I want to say a word or two about prayer, because it's been my observation as I travel around that some people get very uptight about prayer. Ha-ha! That's religion! Well, I'm here tonight on the finest of authority and the highest of authority to tell you that organized religion has no monopoly on prayer and it does not have any patent rights on prayer. That prayer belongs to you. It's as personal to you as your bank account. The Master only taught us one prayer. He said, Our Father, a beautiful prayer that we use to close our meetings with. Very often I reflect on that when I'm traveling long distances in my car sometimes, and I have an opportunity to reflect on it. And I very seldom get past the first two words because they're so beautiful. They tell me what God's relationship is to me and what my relationship is to God. They tell me of what your relationship is to me and my relationship to you. They contain a complete and total system of theology almost. I really don't require much more than that. But you see, when I was a child, I studied an old Butler catechism, and one of the questions in that catechism said, what is prayer? And I always remember it said, prayer is an elevation of the thoughts to God. It didn't say it was a Hail Mary, a Gloria Dei, a Litany, or any of those sort of things. It's an elevation of the thoughts to God. The poet says it so beautifully when he says to want to pray is a prayer in itself. Sister Ignatia, in the early days of our fellowship, who was so instrumental in helping so many drunks, she single-handedly opened the doors of St. Thomas Hospital in Akron, Ohio, to admit drunks for the first time in the history of the United States that drunks had ever been admitted to a general hospital because they were drunks. Needless to say, her accomplishments were followed by others, and needless to say, St. Thomas Hospital was loaded with drunks. They were hanging from the rafters, the nooks, the crannies, the flower beds, over the beds, under the beds, everywhere you looked, there was a drunk. And the story is told one day that Sister Ignatia was going down the corridor, and the whole corridor was lined with drunks. There's an old drunk laying over there in a cot, and he was making more noise than all the rest. He was hacking and coughing and spitting and carrying on. And as Sister went by, he shouted over. He said, Sister, come over here. So she went over, and he said, Sister, he says, I want you to pray for me. He said, I think I'm going to die. She looked at him and she said, pray for yourself. He likes to hear from strangers. Yeah. And then we come to the 12th step. And it says, having had a spiritual awakening, as a result of these steps, we try to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. At the outset of my remarks this evening, I asked you to consider two things, that there was a price to be paid and a door to be opened. I don't know about your country, but in my country, in the fall of every year, the automotive industry bring out new models. And we all get very excited about new models of cars, and whether we can buy one or not, we usually go and see what improvements and changes they've made. And we're deluged from all sides about these new models, and so next Thursday night they're going to have a showing of the new models, and we don't even have to inquire where the dealership is, because he spent a lot of money telling us he's rented one of those big searchlights in the sky and so on. And we drive down, we park on a side street, and we go over to the sales lot, and it's lit up brighter than day. The banners are flying. Hey, there's music in the air. It's a real carnival atmosphere. And we come to the showroom door, and we open the door, and our breath is taken away. All the engineering skill of the century has gone into the production of their very finest model. And with our eyes glued to it without removing them, we walk ever so carefully towards this model without removing our eyes. And when we get within distance, we reach out and we touch the paint job. Oh, my, that's nice. And we walk along the distance of the automobile and we come to the corner and we kick the tire. You got to kick the tire. We walk down the other side of the automobile and we slam the door. There's something about slamming a new car door that we like to hear the sound of. And the last thing we look at is the price tag. We come out of the limbo land that we've lived in for so long, and we come to the church steps where the meeting is held. The room is lit up brighter than day. The outstretched hands are the banners. The laughter is the music. And we're brought into the midst of love. Someone will share their experience, strength, and hope with you. And when that meeting is over, always an old-timer, and God bless them, I love them, will walk forward and place into your hands this very precious gift. You will fondle it like a piece of Dresden china. You will begin to walk. You will walk ever so carefully, ever, ever so carefully, till you come to the first corner, and you kick the hell out of it. You slam the door, and the last thing you look at is the price tag. Since coming to Alcoholics Anonymous, my friends, I will never know why God has blessed me so abundantly. Oh, I'm privileged today to be blessed in very many ways. I have a flourishing business, I have a nice home and a car, clothes, and I travel. But these things no longer represent what they once did in my life. Oh, we all remember the days, don't we? When it was the end all of everything, to have the big house on the hill, and the two-car garage, and the two cars, and the two wives, and all the things that went with it. Well, we don't have to live that way anymore. I have some blessings that no price tag in the world can be placed upon, that you people have shown me how to obtain, because as I travel among my fellow man and I realize that once again I am privileged to enjoy the respect of my fellow man, not only in this program but also out of it. In this program, as I've already told you, you have extended to me the privilege of being your servant. Outside of this program, there rests on the books of the town of Oakville, the city of Oakville, a resolution that is 19 years old. That resolution is endorsed by many of the prominent citizens of that community, and the resolution is to the effect of asking me to leave that community because I had brought disgrace to public office. The same people who endorsed that resolution are the same people who went out 7 years ago and worked very long, very hard, under very adverse weather conditions to return me to City Hall. I say that with a very grateful heart, not as one in any egotistical sense, but as one who has been able to bring a sober mind to our council table. When I return from this beautiful roundup this weekend, I will once again be in the midst of my family, a family that I humiliated and disgraced, and a family whose love and respect I am privileged to enjoy today. In closing, I want to say a word or two about my family. Because, you see, when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I knew not how sick I was. And it is only in retrospect that I'm able to see what had transpired was that I had built a wall around myself. I wanted no part of any man. I had tried so desperately to become an island, and no man is an island. Through the prayers of a loving mother and the grace of God working through the people of AA, you found a chink in the armor of that wall, and you dragged me through, and you brought me to Alcoholics Anonymous. I had not been in Alcoholics Anonymous very long before I made a very shattering discovery. The discovery that I made, my friends, was that you not only cared about me, but that you also loved me. And that frightened me. I became very frightened because my concept of love was soiled, distorted, and sordid. And I ran to a very beautiful man that I came to love very much, Reg Brown, an old-timer. And I told him of the dilemma that I found myself in, and I asked him what I had to do. And he said, "You have to pray." I respected Reg enough that if he said you prayed, you prayed. But what baffled me was that how could God, in all his mercy, in all his kindness, in all his omnipotence, bring love into the life of a lonely old bachelor alcoholic that didn't want any part of it? And he chose the most beautiful way to do it. He chose my family. My oldest sister, who was younger than I am, had been married for a number of years, and about 13 years ago, they had no children, so they adopted a little boy. Now, I have a lot of nieces and nephews that I love very dearly, but none, absolutely none, do I love as much as I love David. Not only was I privileged to become his uncle, I was also privileged to become his godfather. And they're a very wonderful young couple, and they shared little David a great deal with my mother and myself. And it was a great joy to my mother in her declining years to have the love of David. And I guess it was all right for an old bachelor uncle to spoil him. And on Sunday morning after Mass, they would come into the house for breakfast, and it kind of became a family breakfast, and things were going so well. And as David began to walk and talk and grow, he and I grew very, very close together, and we still are. And we played all the games that children play, and the game that he liked the most was hide and seek. And I would hide in my den when I would see them coming down the street from the church. And I can hear David yet storming through the front door and saying in great loud voice to his grandma, "Where is Uncle Peter?" And mother would be busy in the kitchen getting breakfast, and she'd say, "Well, now I don't know, and I haven't time to look for him. You go look for him, he's here somewhere." And he'd look under the table and in the closet and all the silly places, and in a few moments, he'd come back to his grandma, and I could hear him tearfully and whinefully saying to her, "I can't find him." And mother, I'm sure, would wink at him because she'd say, "You keep looking, he's here somewhere." And in a moment or two, the den door would be pushed open, and the most beautiful smile I've ever seen in my whole life would light up his little face. And he'd say, "Ha, I find you." And he'd run across the room real fast, scramble up on my lap, and put his arms very tightly around my neck and give me a big sloppy kiss on the cheek. And he'd say, "Uncle Pete, I love you. I've come to know that you couldn't stay in this program. You couldn't live in this program for 2 minutes without love. The miracle of my life tonight is that I can love you. And I love you very, very much. I love each and every one of you. I love you for a million reasons, but I love you most of all because you've let me be me. Right? You do your thing and I do mine. I am not in this world to live up to your expectations. You're not in this world to live up to mine. But if perchance as we travel through this valley of tears that you and I can meet, that can be beautiful." And nowhere else in my life have I ever experienced meeting with all that that word implies as I have in the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. Bill talks about it in his writings. He calls it the language of the heart. It transcends the appearance and the personality of the individual, and it goes directly to the soul. I do a lot of traveling, and I do a lot of talking in AA. And sometimes you get up at one of these gatherings and you begin to feel like the village pump. Just put them up there and pump them and something will come out. And tonight, the purpose of my sharing with you is not to tell you how great I am, but really to tell you how great you are. You see? I would hope that what we have experienced in this weekend
from beginning to end is a beautiful act of love. A beautiful act of love. See, there's a great deal of difference between being present with you tonight and present to you. In the days that lie ahead, it will not be possible for you and I to be present with one another. For that matter, we live in different countries. Our paths, indeed, it may be a long before our paths will cross again. But I want you to know that you shall always be present to me. You shall be my joy and my inspiration and my strength, but above all, you will be my love. I fear not what God may ask of me as I travel through this journey. I fear not whatever His will is for me from one day to the next as God grants it to me. I have no fear of that whatsoever, because I know that as I go forth, I take that strength, and I take that inspiration, and I take that joy, and I take that love that you so generously give. It shall sustain me. My cup runneth over. This has been indeed a very beautiful experience for me to come to the great state of Texas, to meet so many loving and beautiful people, to share with you. And whenever I'm at a gathering such as this, it is always my fondest wish that I could ask you to take something with you. Not of a material sense, no. That would not make much sense. But I would ask you to take with you tonight, in your hearts, a prayer that was written by a man who lived in this world 700 years ago. A man who went through the emotional ringer that we've gone through, who knew the fears and the remorse and the degradation that we've experienced. And of course, this man was St. Francis of Assisi. He said, "Lord, make me an instrument of thy peace. Where there is hatred, let me sow love. Where there is injury, pardon. Where there is despair, hope. Where there is darkness, light. Where there is sadness, joy. O Divine Master, grant that I may not so much seek to be consoled as to console, to be understood as to understand, to be loved as to love. For it is in giving that we receive, it is in pardoning that we are pardoned, and it is in dying that we are born to eternal life." May God bless you.